I want to organize our consideration around a paradox and say a few opening remarks about each side of the paradox. One side of the paradox says, ours is a time of unprecedented human power. There is a novel range, a novel set of consequences, a novel quantity of human power in our time. We'll give some illustrations. Again, I ask for your own reflections and illustrations as well. The other side of the paradox is that vast numbers of people seem to feel powerless in a time of unprecedented human power. Now, that wouldn't be a surprise for considerable numbers of people who don't have access to social power. If you think about Jesus and the people in the Jesus movement, the people drawn to Jesus, those were people who had relatively little access to social power, and part of the power of Jesus was precisely because he empowered them and drew from them a power that they did not know they had. It's not surprising that in our time, the people who don't have access to much social, political, economic power would feel powerless. But it is a surprise to find among middle-class ranks of the North Atlantic world such a pervasive feeling of powerlessness. Exactly the ranks of those who are now exercising unprecedented human power by all measures of human history are ranks in which there is this sense of relative powerlessness. I want to explore that paradox. But the emphasis in these opening remarks is really on the first part of the paradox. Is ours a time, a new era of human power? Is it a time of a new novel range, novel consequences, novel subjects, novel quantity of human power? A few illustrations of that fact. In 1973, Stanley Cohen and Herbert Boyer first spliced genetic material from one microbe into another to create a bit of life that never existed before. In 1973, you had the first time that human beings created life forms that had never happened before, created a life form that hadn't previously existed. It rested upon the work of James Watson and Francis Crick, who in 1953 determined the chemical arrangement of DNA. DNA, that double helix strand which carries the hereditary blueprint of all living things. And in 1987, the United States Patent and Trademark Office decided that patents for new life forms can be extended from microbes to higher life forms, including the mammals. So we are now in a time of human power where it's in its infancy, but we are in a time of human power when we manipulate the very building blocks of life itself. Before, we could alter indirectly the course of evolution. Now we can alter directly the course of evolution and can, in fact, create life forms and patent them forms which did not exist before. That's a new dimension, a new range, probably in all likelihood new consequences of human power. I don't know about where you live. Where I lived for a while, in Washington, D.C., a whole series of new industries took place along I-270 north out of Washington. Biotechnologies, Gentech, genetic technologies, etc. One example of new human powers. The biblical communities and all others until the mid 20th century did not possess the knowledge or the power to manipulate the basic building blocks of life itself. Genetic engineering, genetic counseling are new words in the vocabulary of human power and human moral responsibility. Biotechnology, it's a curious word. If you had said biotechnology to someone a century ago, you'd have gotten a blank response on the face. Biotechnology. Bioethics, another new word in the human vocabulary, words which harbor awesome potential power. And like all increases of human power, they carry corollary moral responsibility. Nor did previous epochs fondle nuclear triggers and carry responsibility for enough destructive power to radically alter, if not terminate, life as we know it. That capacity to terminate the life experiment as we know it did not exist until this century. As the Pope mentioned on one occasion, it is for the first time in human history that we choose whether or not there will be future generations, that has become a human choice. And all previous generations have simply assumed that life will go on. And I might add, all previous ethical systems have assumed that life will go on. Now it must be a choice on the part of human beings that life goes on. Nuclear fission and, on the horizon, nuclear fusion are new words in the human vocabulary. They are words, needless to say, that talk of enormous power. Strategic defense initiatives, strategic missiles are new words. That's a second example. A third example of the novel range, novel consequences, not so much new powers, but new cumulative results of the exercise of human power, has to do with the increased human impact upon the natural environment. It turns out, I don't know if you saw the item in the paper, it's really quite amusing. It turns out that President Reagan's comment that trees pollute may in fact be true. There is a contribution of the trees to acid rain. I think it's wonderful that almost illiterate statement turned out to be perhaps factually the case. But more importantly, for our purposes, acid rain is a new word in the human vocabulary because it reflects a cumulative result of increased human power and impact upon the environment. And we have in our time a new possibility, an ominous one, people are waking up to it, that an age-old assumption that we have lived by is no longer tenable, namely that one can do no lasting injury to nature, that nature is never spent. Nature is, as we all know, simply wondrously fecund and resilient, but it's now true that nature can be subjected to lasting injury. And a population of 5 billion of people, we just passed the mark short time ago, pushes very hard against the carrying capacity of the environment. That phrase itself, carrying capacity, is a new phrase. It didn't occur to people. People have always affected their environment. They've often destroyed it. That's true, incidentally, also of people who were sensitive to it, like Native Americans. But it didn't occur to people to think about the carrying capacity of the planet itself, because we had never had such widespread cumulative effects on the envelope of life, including now the atmosphere, as we know from the recent concerns, not just with acid rain, but with the ozone layer. We've always said the sky's the limit, and we meant by that there is no limit. Now we have to say the sky's the limit and mean by that there is a limit. I want to just cite two sources to say that changing our basic assumption that nature is not subject to lasting injury or is never spent still runs very deep in us. I'll cite an ancient text. That won't surprise you that it's there. But then I want to cite a modern one. In the chorus of Antigone is this verse, the stanza. Many the wonders, but nothing more wondrous than man. This thing crosses the sea in the winter storm, making his path through the roaring waves. And she, the greatest of gods, the earth, deathless she is and unwearied. He wears her away as the plows go up and down from year to year, and his mules turn up the soil. In Antigone, you have this picture of humanity. It's a paean of praise of humanity, wearing upon earth. Plows go up and down, cross the waves, paths through the roaring waves. But the greatest of gods, the earth, deathless she is, and unwearied despite this treatment. That's an ancient text. Now, a new hymn. It was composed and first sung last October, to my knowledge, for a convocation at Union Seminary in Riverside Church. It's a wonderful hymn, I must say. It's entitled God's Grandeur, and part of it goes like this. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out, shining like shook foil. So you can tell it's a new hymn. You wouldn't have Bach writing about shook foil. All right. Will flame out, shining like shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do we then not wreck your rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears our smudge and shares our smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the deepest, dearest freshness, there lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, O morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost broods over the bent world, broods with warm breast and, bright wings. Now, don't try to put all those together in a coherent sentence. The point is that for all of this, that smeared with, seared with trade, bleared, smeared with our toil, the earth wears our smudge and shares our smell, the soil is bare now, for all of that, nature is never spent, because of a dearest freshness deep down things and the Holy Spirit brooding over this resilience. It's a notion that you cannot do injury. Yeah?
That may be a new hymn, but the poem, I believe, is by Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Aha, you're right. Thank you for that. It is. The music is
new. Somebody said it's music.
I'll think of his name in a minute. Thank you for that source. In fact, it's a little bit embarrassing because I used it in a paper and I just copied it off the program, and the publisher called me about it, and I didn't know where it was, and I had to run it down. And now I've forgotten again that it was Gerard Manley, because I remember that I told him I didn't have any idea where that came from. It continues to be the case. Okay. So these are just some few examples of new human power: biotechnology, nuclear reality, cumulative impact upon the environment. That's one mark of the changed human power of our time. I'll note a second one, and then we'll go to some discussion. The second mark of ours as a new era of human power is the context of the exercise of this power. Not just new consequences, not just novel range, not just new subjects like DNA, but the setting in which this new power is exercised. This is almost a truism, but it is not one that dare go unspoken. Ours is a smaller, tighter, more interdependent world in which this heightened power is happening. The global economy is a fact. You have not just the internationalizing of capital, that's been underway for some time, and of markets, that's been underway for some time. We have now the internationalization of labor as well. Transnational corporations are very mobile and can choose different places anywhere in the world as their labor supply. And so we have the internationalizing of capital, of markets, and of trade, and I don't know anyone who says that the basic unit in the world, in the economy these days, is no longer the nation. It is the world. George Shultz said that when he was Secretary of the Treasurer. He said also that it calls into question almost all of our assumptions which still operate on a nation-state basis in our planning of the economy. That's one example of an altered context. We have, secondly, a smaller, tighter, more interdependent world in terms of security. That's directly related to the fact that ours is a time of the power of weapons of mass destruction. One of the most significant of Gorbachev's statements is the one in which he contended that domestic security of the Soviet Union, now domestic security, is dependent now on world security. That no national borders represent borders of safety any longer, apart from a international security system or a transnational system of security. Incidentally, just these are all editorials. I think we have great reason to be optimistic about major arms agreements in Geneva this fall, because of the dawning realization that domestic security and transnational security are so intimately related to one another. And the press there, for lots of reasons, including domestic reasons, is such that it's quite likely that we'll get a major agreement even between two ferociously competitive superpowers. Then a third example of a smaller, tighter, more interdependent world is the global interdependence on environmental issues. That too is becoming a kind of truism, that borders are not significant boundaries anymore when it comes to the cumulative impact of human power on the world around us. We still have to work, oftentimes as nation states with one another, and you've seen how much difficulty we've had between the United States and Canada, our friendliest friend, in getting any place on who's going to be responsible for that acid rain. Nonetheless, there is the growing realization that we have an interdependence of the environment. It's always been there, but that is the environment knows no borders. But the new era of human power means that we have to come to terms with our increased impact upon that environment in new ways. All right, let's just stop here. I even stopped 5 minutes before I said I was going to. Another broken promise. And let me just ask you what other illustrations or what reflections you might have upon this thesis that ours is a new era of human power. What are there further examples? Yeah.
There's an ability being demonstrated to cope with these things. If you take a place like Pittsburgh, for example, where 50 years ago it was a mess and today it's cleaned up, beautiful, progressive, and they've been able to do something.
That's a very good point. Not only is it an increase in human powers and a capacity to do more, there's also the capacity to do more quickly. It has become so much a part of our ethos that we probably don't recognize the obvious here. But think how fast Germany and Japan rebuilt total societies, that is, materially rebuilt total societies. The distance from 1945, when both those nations lay in utter ruin, to the power that they've had already half that stretch of time since then. They are major powers. In fact, we have second thoughts about how much we should have helped Japan in this. But I mean, Pittsburgh is a good example, but it just brings to mind this capacity to exercise power of transformation at really enormous speed, so to speak. Yeah.
How about the renewal of the Great Lakes?
Yeah, there's another example of turning things around rather quickly. Lake Erie now has lots of fishing boats on it again. There's even a few commercial fisher people on Lake Erie. When was it that the Cuyahoga River in downtown Cleveland burned?
About 65.
Yeah. There was so much pollution that the river burned and burned down the bridge. And pollution started on fire. And then continued on into Lake Erie.
Well, I think those are good examples, but I think it's important to point out that a lot of the pollution that resulted in that kind of burning has now been exported.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the transnational movement has been to move those operations away from here and to put them in places that are unable or unwilling to put restrictions on.
That's right. Go where the laws aren't so tight and it's not so hard on the profit margin. We do that with not only pollution, we do that with goods themselves, things which won't meet safety standards here, we sell to somebody else, like flammable pajamas for kids. Yeah.
Just to add to that, I guess the thing that's striking to me about power relationships now is how much more the poor are marginalized worldwide.
Mm.
I mean, that the powerful have strong relationships with each other, but generally exclude or end up kind of stomping on the poor or excluding them at best. So there's an international alliance of power that's different.
I suppose one of the most frequent refrains in studies of development is the growing gap between rich and poor, both within nations and between nations, and the growing collusion between the rich across nations. That is, the rich people in poor nations are a part of the same system as rich nations themselves in this more interdependent world. And as you say, larger numbers of poor people, both internal to nations and then whole nations of the poor themselves, are there. And that has intensified in the last decade as well. There are some salient exceptions to that. South Asia has, Taiwan, South Korea, and then farther north, Japan, Singapore, Hong Kong. It is not, there's been an exception to this growing gap between rich nations and poor nations there, but it is just that, an exception. The larger picture is a bleaker picture. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking about when you mentioned Japan and Germany after the war, as you also indicated, they certainly had good assistance and encouragement from the United States to rebuild, but also, like in Nehemiah, the people had a willingness to work. They wanted to reestablish, and that has to be a responsibility for individuals who want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a culture, and there was sheer human necessity of having to rebuild. It happened to be in the self-interest of the United States to encourage that, because we held the power and we held the goods, and that made for increased power to do so. And the Marshall Plan was in our best interest by far, just as the GI Plan was in our best interest to educate people coming back so as to help the economy. Yeah. Other thing, yes.
Are there any international discussions that go on a regular basis that have to deal with this emerging gap? How the larger nations are polluting and purposely destroying and moving into poorer nations?
There are. On a continuous basis, one of the chief forums is the United Nations and commissions of the United Nations. There have been, for example, declarations of a development decade and things organized around that. There are many, many international conferences. There are some standing commissions in the United Nations on transnational corporations, a code agreed upon to many countries for the behavior of transnationals in their countries. The World Bank and other multilateral institutions also carry on some discussions. The brute fact, however, is that if the most powerful nations don't cooperate, then nothing effective can be done. And the effort to seriously organize this economically and the call for a new international economic order, an IEO, and the effort to establish a law of the seas treaty were both sabotaged simply by non-cooperation of the most powerful nations, the United States in the first instance, others in the North Atlantic world as well.
It seems a good place to mention Bread for the World as a Christian citizens lobby, which attempts to work within our system and bring about policy as well as legislation in our Congress that has a lot to do with economic development and dealing with some of these issues. And it's not certainly at the level of the World Bank.
But no, it certainly isn't.
And it requires very patient work. But it is a channel through which folks like us can be somehow involved.
Yeah. Washington, D.C., and I'm sure other places as well, is just full of all sorts of non-governmental groups that are very concerned about these issues and are trying to cultivate a voice from a variety of constituencies. But there is more going on, of necessity. I mean, sheer self-interest pushes us to do that. No, but go ahead, Pierre. No, I left that off, and that's another important one.
I don't know that I need to say more than that. There seems people that... the thing that comes to mind immediately is the way EMS worked with the Lutheran Church, the emerging church in it. So they kind of thought of themselves as a community of guerrillas working to hold that image captive by their own kind of negative addition to it. Another thing is in Ethiopia, when they did a documentary, an almost immediate worldwide organization.
That's a very good example. The response to the famine in Ethiopia was one almost totally dependent upon electronic media. That is to say, people on the scene had been saying for a long time, we've got a serious problem of malnutrition and starvation here. That word had been put out through groups like Lutheran World Relief. It didn't get a response. Peter, what was his last name, the guy who did the film, did a film on it, showed it on the BBC in Great Britain, or whatever the television portion of the BBC is, and it suddenly became a worldwide reality and started making the evening major network news, etc. I'm glad you brought that example. I totally left that out. Ours is an electronic age.
I was going to say you hadn't mentioned artificial intelligence.
No, I hadn't. Another dimension of electronics and of new human power. There you've both got new arenas, and you've got a factor of speed. Information is not only much more abundant, but information can be shared almost instantaneously. In fact, the stock markets now in some places are open 24 hours a day, or some brokers are, because people from all over the world call in their requests and make their deals, and so you can't have it shut down just because it's 2 o'clock in the morning. And someone else, and for them it's 10 o'clock in the morning. That's when they want to make their phone call. You've got a worldwide network of electronic media. Now there are curiosities here. It means that I, sitting in my apartment on 122nd and Broadway, may know more information about something halfway around the world than I know about what's going on 2 blocks down from me, because I have access through some means to do that. I was in Tanzania for a little while on a sabbatical project studying development issues. Went there to get first-hand information about some efforts that Julius Nyerere and the Tanzanian government had sponsored in their program of African socialism. I had gone there from Washington, returned to Washington, found out before long at all that I had much better information about Tanzania 3 blocks from my house in Washington than I could get in Tanzania. It had been done, it had been communicated, it had been compiled, it had been worked through there, and I could hardly get around in Tanzania itself. So the electronics age shifts all sorts of power relations and is a power itself by virtue of increased information and the manipulation of information. Yeah.
That's rather than from and about manipulation, because the Ethiopia project was certainly wonderful, worthwhile exposure. But then there is a lot of left-wing information comes over on the TV.
And a lot of right-wing information comes over on the TV.
Not enough.
Most of it is. Actually, this is one of the, this is one of the real serious issues these days for which the structures of democracy are not very adequate. Namely, people in a democracy vote their interests as they understand them, but they're dependent upon free flowing information. And when you've got the power of the electronic media, you've already got a power of filtering information, both consciously and unconsciously.
I don't know if you want to explore this, but I'm intrigued by the element of motivation and your mention of the exceptions, Korea, South Korea,
yeah.
Japan, Singapore,
yeah.
Hong Kong, Taiwan. There's such varying factors there, but how are they related to the successes that have been apparent in those areas? I look at our neighbor down to the south in Mexico, and I'm acquainted with some Mexican personnel, and I have great admiration for them. But is the same thing possible to happen in Mexico that has happened in Taiwan? The motivation of people to do it, to respond to the opportunity.
I can't give you an answer that satisfies me, and it certainly won't be satisfactory to you, I wouldn't think. There are so many complex factors involved there that I don't think you can reduce the matter to any single one. There are cultural factors which are important. It's not by coincidence that the DDR, East Germany, despite the fact that it was an agricultural country and had almost no industrial base at all except some steel mills at Leipzig and so on, after World War II soon became the major industrial power in the Eastern Bloc and had the highest standard of living. It may now be exceeded by Hungary, I'm not sure about that. Part of that was cultural. Germans work hard, and whether it's capitalism or socialism, they end up putting together industrial and technological society of considerable viability. Some factors are not cultural. Some of them are the ability simply to structure an economy, and you can bring that in such a way that if you've got enough of the kinds of goods and powers and channels of trade, etc., to do it, you can locate almost anywhere. In Tanzania, in Arusha, we had the Philips Company, a big Dutch corporation that made radios. We had General Tire. The radios made there, the tires made there, were as good as General Tire's made anywhere in the world, including parent company in Britain. But had to bring it all in, had to set it all up. So some factors aren't. Cultural, other factors are. Are cultural. Now that's an inadequate answer. South Asia has found its niche in the world economy partly by getting in on the front end of electronics itself, which was the expanding sector, and thus computers, thus cameras, thus all sorts of things that you can do in relatively small space. There's another factor. You had all sorts of people, you had a small space. What kinds of industries will work there, the kinds that they managed to get in on? Or you can do banking and financing there, and Hong Kong is becoming an enormous finance center. Singapore is as well. So what kinds of things is a third sort of thing. Yes?
I guess I want to also mention increased ability to manipulate, control, and change. Natural intelligence, human intelligence, manipulate the brain, the mind, and behavior of people.
Yeah.
I don't really have that down as
No, we don't. And some of these areas I'm skittish about even entering into, but you're absolutely right to bring them up. It's an awesome power, utterly awesome. Now, I want to do something just very quickly, and we'll still have a little time to get into the second thing, and that maybe that's another whole session, why the feeling of relative powerlessness among so many people in such an age of awesome power. Even those, Jack has been good to remind us that for increasing numbers of people, it's because they simply are powerless, and that's going away. I want also to talk about those who aren't, but who feel so. And I there's a kind of social amnesia in the middle class in this country that is, to me, extremely scary. And I'm genuinely frightened by responses favorable to people like Oliver North, because I think it's by people who feel relative powerlessness, finding someone who exercises power according to the kinds of beliefs that they also hold. And there's a response which has just delights in a kind of Rambo response, and it's out of powerlessness, but it's identifying with a figure that somehow did it. And I don't want to miss that. But first I want to go to this comment, not your example, but the whole issue of control, and briefly characterize the kind of view of the world which our modern power derives from, or better yet, expresses. And I put on the board what I call the modern quartet. If you want to know who's singing in this era, I have to warn you, first of all, it's an all-male cast. That may not surprise you. It may make you angry, but that may not surprise you. Francis Bacon, lead tenor here. Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, and Max Weber. Now, these are just handles for describing an era. I'm not attributing to the members of the quartet the entire composition that we sing. They're just handles. They happen to be influential folks. Francis Bacon, for his contention, and with the rise of science and the application of science via technology, absolutely critical to the power of humans in the modern era. Namely, knowledge is power, and power is control. The mark for us is that we have science as a way of knowing that has yielded a great deal of power, and technology as applied science. It would be another whole session to talk about the history of this, but it has not always been the case that you've had a powerful science, and even when you've had a powerful science, it hasn't always been linked to the application of science by way of technology. All kinds of technology in the human story has grown up on the trial and error method. It has not been a systematic move from knowledge as power to power as control. And Bacon is the one who articulated this. However, Bacon's arena was nature, non-human nature. Karl Marx came along and said that we can turn to society as the powerful, as the object of powerful knowledge. Marx helps establish a science of society, makes social analysis a tool for power. You can make society an object to the human mind, and then go about trying to structure society in keeping with the knowledge and power you have. That's what Marx brings to that. Isn't that, nobody ever thought of that before? Marx makes it a a way of going about things. Nobody talks anymore about on the early side of Marx. Everybody talks about social structures and systems and how they work and how they can be changed. That is to make science the object of power, humanly created power. Third in the quartet, Sigmund Freud. If Marx places society on the agenda of power, like Bacon placed nature, Freud added the psyche, or the self. The approach is the same, only the object of our knowing and of our power changes. Science knows in a subject-object relationship, technique is developed to effect a desired outcome. Joe's in the middle of his session on men's feelings. That people will start thinking now, how do I change myself in keeping with that? So the self, the human self, makes itself the object of knowledge and power in an effort to control it as something external to us, really. Now, I want to just read you an advertisement from the American University in Washington. It showed up on the board in the Campus Ministry Center, and I just want you to listen to it. Here's an ad, beginning of the school year. Interpersonal skill building groups. In these 10-session skill-focused groups, students will be taught to monitor and master anxiety using improved social skills by learning to be appropriately assertive. The flyer goes on to speak of designing experiences. Hear it? This is an engineer's view of the world, but the self is the object. You design experiences and you acquire techniques for, quote, establishing trust. The goal is to teach the self to monitor and master its own anxiety by positioning itself rightly in a web of relationship of which it is part and of which it can, with knowledge as power, also, quote, construct. The world of psyche joins the world of nature, joins the world of society as worlds known and controlled by human power. So, Well, then, finally, the last one, Max Weber. Weber is the great student of human organizations and of bureaucracy. And so I just point to him as an example of someone who focuses on the institutional character of society. And Weber's contention is that our culture is one of, he called it, bureaucratic individualism. By that he meant we think the individual is the basic unit of human reality and the locus of chief interest and the seat of authority and the object of fulfillment. But the medium of human action is mass organization, a division of labor and mass organizational pursuits of goals. That's bureaucracy. That's how we organize human action if we're going to get anything done and keep it done. He calls it bureaucratic individualism. So you've got Bacon making nature a world objective to us, over which we exercise control or try to. Marx making society that object, Freud making the self itself, the psyche, that object, and Weber characterizing our time as one in which the primary medium is mass organization of power. All of that is a spelling out of what occurred at the beginning of our epoch, which I think we have to date from the Enlightenment. And the dominant image since the Enlightenment of human beings is the image of dominance. The master image for our understanding our own humanity is the image of mastery itself, making all of those things objects to us, of which we are then the manipulators. And I that's a quick characterization of the form of human power in the modern era, and I think that goes on. My feminist colleagues have deep criticisms of that kind of power and that way of looking at the world. They not only point out that it aspires for control and ends up producing all sorts of irrationalities. You don't get the control. But they point up the fact that when you make all these things an object to you, you lose something absolutely essential in the process itself. And you put the world over against you as stuff, as plastic. Remember the movie where Mrs. Robinson was in it? Anyway, The Graduate, John. He graduates, and by the swimming pool, he gets this advice. Just wants to say one thing about the future. Give this first graduate some advice. What's the future about? Plastics. This is a way of making self, society, psyche, plastic. And the feminist criticism of that kind of male power is that it is destructive of the relationship of the human to the rest of life itself. Nuts. Now I've... let me get at least a quick response from you to this sort of worry about a feeling of powerlessness. Or let me just pose it as a question. Maybe it's not a serious matter at all. Do you find that folks like us and the circles in which you move are circles in which people feel relatively powerless? Maybe I'm just misreading matters.
I don't know powerlessness, but I guess I think one of the things that I notice is a frightening lack of critical thinking skills. But people just, you know, read it and can't sort it out, or don't really read it, or don't listen. And that, I guess that's what's frightening to me.
That may be in part due to the impact of electronic media, which do not nurture those kinds of skills at all. You can get conflicting images, conflicting messages, but you don't get the skills
how to make a decision, how to sort things out. When I was in high school in the 70s, and those were the big things that we were learning then. And I guess, it seems sad that some of us have lost that, and then it's not being taught anymore, because that was, that was a stage we were going through. At various levels, but I still think it's something that, at least in the area of the country that we're in, it's still seen as then that gives kids too much control. And then they'll make decisions and their parents won't have power over them. I've heard it over and over, so it's not just something I'm spitting out.
It's a frightening prospect to think of actual increased human powers going hand in hand with fewer and fewer abilities to offer serious critical perspectives. Now, what about other people's response to the contention that there is a feeling of powerlessness?
In the town that I live,
dominated by a logging mill owned by a multinational corporation for which that little mill is a drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
And if the corporation says, do this, there's certainly a feeling of, you know, powerlessness in the face of that.
Yeah.
Even to the fact that the company then can pursue a policy of raping the forest for quick profit with no regard for the land. You know, and those folks are saying 50% cut, fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if we say no, you just close us down.
That's right. What's the alternative there?
We don't. There's no problem.
Yeah. The folks there that you're in your parish then are. They feel relatively powerless. That is, they can't make the decisions in the very economy on which they are dependent.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter who we choose for president, all politicians are corrupt. We don't have any voice, or it really doesn't matter. Why we vote?
Yeah, why? Do you think that's the reason? I wonder why. The level of participation of voting has gone steadily down. Ronald Reagan was elected by a considerable majority of those voting, but he was elected by 29% of the eligible voters in this country because that has gone down. Of course, part of that's an old theme in American history. We're a curious people. We love the nation and hate the government. And so we end up with presidents who run against the government and get elected on that ballot. And this funny thing where you have people campaigning against the public good. We have almost no sense of the common good and the public welfare and getting elected on that reason. It's a funny thing, but I don't know. What's the powerlessness there?
There's a paradox here, I think, to a certain extent. Our isolated examples, if it's power and apathy, then it is a powerlessness.
Mm.
I think there are some international economists who would say that in South America or Mexico and so forth, the problem there is the super rich middle class.
Yes.
And the opportunity to things that need to be done to help create a middle class in those countries is where the problems lie. You know, you've got the super rich to control over and make this as difficult as possible. Where other countries, look at our country, look, the middle class is the rich.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have all that power, but we've had it so long and we're so comfortable and can't lose it.
Mm-hmm.
We're sort of apathetic to the reason.
Mm-hmm. So it's not powerlessness so much as it is, well, as you say, apathy or sort of settling in. Yeah, one more comment and then.
We don't make a connection. We don't realize how we're globally connected.
Yeah.
You walk to your local supermarket, you're not getting stuff from the backyard, you're getting it from all
over
the world.
Yes.
And we're political in that sense. You know, we're participating in the structures that are keeping these poor people poor.
Yeah.
We're not making a connection.
No, we aren't. Yeah, yeah. No, there's a huge education there. When we moved from Washington to New York, the congregation we were a part of gave us a little Statue of Liberty radio. It sits on my desk in my office. Nice little radio, Statue of Liberty. On the back of it, it says official radio for the Statue of Liberty commemoration. We rededicated it after we fixed it all up. And then it says, made in Korea. Thank you.